I thought I heard a sound podcast.
This is a public service announcement.
Everything would be all right if everything was put back in the hands of the people. And we're going to have to put it back in the hands of the people.
Because I always feel like running. Not away, because there's no such place.
Okay, cool. So, Jason Miles of Bitter Lake.
Yes.
Thank you so much for deciding to talk to me and my little blog.
Thank you for reaching out to me. I always get, I'm not going to lie, man, I get excited every time someone reaches out and listens to my band, since we've been so physically inactive, not so much releasing music, but as far as playing live. So that means a lot.
Yeah. When was the last show you actually played?
Oh man, you're gonna make me tear up again, as we said off air. The last show we played was at, I believe it was at Bender's Bar in San Francisco, in January of 2020, right before the pandemic.
Okay. Who was all on that bill?
I couldn't tell you. I honestly couldn't tell you. I don't remember. I remember us playing and people kind of looking like, what the hell is this? Because the show is, you know, it's pretty intense, but not in that way that has become almost cliche. So it's always fun to see the what the hell is this reaction from people. And then they just start crowding around. And I remember that very clearly. And I remember people being like, what? Wow. They were just walking by like, what? Didn't expect to see this here. So that's always fun.
Yeah, you do have a really different style. I honestly can't think of a single, you know, quote unquote punk band that is doing what you're doing. It's very moody. It's very cinematic. It has just a lot of different influences that somehow all mixed together well. I'm wondering, like, how you sort of view yourself in sort of the greater sort of pantheon of punk and metal, though, because as much as I would want to describe you as a sludge metal band, I also like am hearing a lot of like post-hardcore, a lot of just straight up like old school hardcore, in sort of the vein of Neurosis. Yeah, like, so how do you sort of view your project in sort of that grand pantheon of underground music?
So I had a band, and I don't know if you got a chance to check it out, before Bitter Lake, with my now ex-wife, and it was called La Fin Absolute du Monde. And we also were a band that people really couldn't put their finger on. And I take a lot of influence from people like Justin Broderick, definitely Faith No More. I'm a huge Faith No More fan. And then film in general. I'm a huge fan of, you know, Philip Glass, of course, Atticus Ross, and a lot of the stuff that even, I can't even think of his name now. Nine Inch Nails, Trent Reznor has done. Even people like Danny Elfman, a lot of the scores that they've done. I like trying to set some sort of mood and atmosphere. So when you go to a show, it's a show, right? It's going to be kind of like a movie. It's going to ebb and flow and then leave you like, that's kind of how, I always wanted to have a live show and also do records. And my last band, La Fin, we actually spent a lot more time doing that. And we also toured a lot more, but I've always, and I'm a little older, so I came from a world where you had to be original. You couldn't just piggyback on somebody doing something and then, you know, this is my version of Neurosis. This is my version of ISIS. Like, I dig what those dudes do a lot, but that's not, their influences aren't my influences. I also have a lot of funk influences, and, you know, I'm a huge George Clinton, James Brown guy, Rick James guy. So those things definitely come out, can come out in the music as well. I grew up as a young person in the church. So especially when you see us live, there'll be almost a gospel flair as well. So trying to mix all that together in some sort of gumbo-like pot has always been what I try to do with any project that I'm in.
Yeah, yeah. So with all of your different influences and, you know, just everything that you want to accomplish with your records and your live shows, how do you decide to cut something out? Because it feels like, you know, obviously just listening to your music, you have a lot of technical capability and you have, you know, pretty strong vision for the project. How do you determine when something just needs to go, when something's just not working?
Well, at this point, the band, the whole project originally was, you know, my wife had a little bit of a breakdown and then just left. So that we had a Le Fin Absolute Du Monde, had a Southeast Asian tour planned. And for me, it was going to be the end. Like, I was tired. We would tour like 6 to 9 months out of the year.
Oh my God.
It was just wearing on us as a couple and as just individuals. And so I kind of wanted to do the Southeast Asia thing because I thought it was cool. She thought it was cool as well. She ended up doing the tour solo, but
oh my God.
But yeah, that was rough for a minute. But Bitter Lake actually comes from me literally sitting in a room going, okay, I don't know what to do. For the last 7 years, I've been doing the same thing with the same person. Now I got to figure out how to do it alone. And maybe I want to add more acoustic instruments. So I was living in a warehouse that's also a rehearsal studio and practice studio in West Oakland, California. I took one of the rental drum sets. Actually, I took parts of different rental drum kits that we had, put together a drum kit and sat in a room and learned how to play the drums enough that I could get ideas recorded. And then I sat for a few weeks, like didn't leave, just to shower. Like it was gross. And like lost a lot of weight. But I sat in there and I was like, okay, I want to learn how to play. And these are the songs I want to play. And I'll get my friends that I know and maybe we can record them together. And so when it came time to start playing live shows, I definitely didn't want to do live shows by myself. My ex and I had already done that thing where it's like two people and a laptop and depend too much on the sound system. And we had invested too much money on buying huge system just in case the house was whack wherever we were at. And I didn't want to have to do all that and bring all that stuff. And so when it came time to actually getting together with other musicians, I used the songs that I had written. I was like, do you guys dig these? And they're like, oh yeah, we dig them. Yeah, teach us the songs or whatever. And then it was like, okay, however you want to play it live, however it's comfortable for you, is how we'll do it. And I'll adjust vocally. And the live show is a little different than what you'll hear on the record, because it's more the songs that the guys want to play and things that changes we put together more so. I would even say more so that they put together to make things a little bit more fluid for them. So I think for me personally, the live show is just a ton of fun because it's very much a group endeavor.
Oh, wow. Okay. So there's really two sides of their lake. There are the recordings that you produce and put out on Bandcamp and distribute and elsewhere. And then there's a live show where you have a band and you have collaborators and you figure out how these songs work within a group dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's no, that's really cool because, like, I don't know. I just love the way that your records sound and just all the different transitions that they go through. And like, just because I'm, you know, a dumb music fan, I would go to a show and like expect to experience something like that at the show. But, you know, it sounds like I'd be confronted with something totally different. So do you think it's better for people to come into, to encounter your live set first and then listen to your records? Or do you think that the records sort of prepare you to understand what's going on in the live sets?
I wish I was self-indulgent enough to have thought all of that out, and then I could give you a proper answer. I will give you my off the top of the head answer, because I never think of it that way. I always think of the live show as I love spontaneity. I'm sure we've all seen artists that sound like the record. That's really cool. I'm not going to sit here and lie and say I don't dig that. Mm-hmm. And I'm constantly blown away by the people that can do that and not have backing tracks. There's a small handful of bands that actually can still pull that off, and I'm always blown away by those guys. And living in a rehearsal space, I got to know a lot of session people, and, you know, hats off to people that can just show up and kick behind like that. But I love spontaneity, and I think if you went and saw the band live, you can definitely hear the tracks again on record. They're going to sound a little different. They're going to sound a little probably muddier, some of the earlier stuff that we still play live. But I always want the live show to be something you have to be there to see, because I almost feel like we live in a world where every moment has to be captured. And this is probably going to sound strange coming from me. So I worked at a lot of music festivals before my other career took off. And I remember some years ago, I was at a festival. I don't know if it was her first festival, but it must have been one of her first festivals. A very popular singer named Lizzo. And part of my job was to fix certain technical things that would break, point of sale systems that would break, and I had to do reports. It was a very boring job. When I say festivals, people always think I was a tech. I was like, no, I did numbers for major companies. It's very boring.
Really, but anyway, important, though. Yeah.
Oh no, it's very important. That's why I have that's why I have a very more nuanced take on where I think music is going from what I see financially compared to what people think they see with downloads. Like, those are two very different things. I was walking to fix something or get, I think I was going to get food, and I never am blown away by an artist at a mainstream music festival because I hate all the music. I'm like an old person. I'm like, can you turn it down?
They are too loud. That is something I hate about festivals for
They're too loud with the DJ's too loud.
I used to be with it, but then they changed what it was. It'll happen to you.
So I was walking by. This was at a festival called Firefly in Dover, Delaware. And I stopped in my tracks. I was like, I don't know who or what this person is, but this is one of the more entertaining things I've ever seen. And I just stood there and watched the whole set, just blown away. And I didn't take out a phone. I didn't even think to take out a phone. I was so blown away. I just had to watch it. And there's only been a handful of performances I can say I've seen in my life where it's like, you just had to be there. So I always want the live show to be a moment where you're just like, I can't even think to take out a phone, man. Like, even if I do, I'm not going to do this justice. Like, I just want to be here in this moment and watch this.
Yeah, that's very cool. Yeah, and I think that is so rare as well for, you know, a musician to engage an audience to the extent that they are like sort of captured by the performance and not more interested in what's going on Twitter or like checking Instagram or something. That's so rare. And I think that's, how often do you feel like you've accomplished that?
As far as my performance or?
Yeah, as far as your performances before the pandemic.
We did a tour in 2019 with a band called Divide and Dissolve. And there were some ups and downs with that tour, and I won't get into, I will say this. We were playing for an audience that didn't really know what to expect. And every night, I feel very confident saying this. And I was actually just talking. I was up north. I live in Mexico now. I was up north in the Bay Area, and I had lunch with one of the guitarists from Bitter Lake, a guy named Todd Buller. And we were talking about that, how like every night people were just kind of like the eyes open, like, what the hell am I seeing? Like, holy moly, what is this? To the point where sometimes at the end of the show there'd be people like crying and stuff. And
oh my gosh.
I've always feel like you're doing something right when that, for me personally, you're doing something right, because I don't think Bitter Lake is the kind of music you're going to like raise your fist to, like, hey, as much as I like that stuff, like, I love Sepultura roots. I wish I could write Sepultura roots, but I just don't know how to write those kinds of songs.
So. Yeah. I mean, well, Sepultura roots, like, I mean, all the different phases of Sepultura, like every single phase has something amazing about it, honestly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like and I think they've basically done every style of metal at this point. Like, you can basically find an album that is like death thrash, black metal, Roots, their quote unquote new metal album. Like,
oh, it's proto new metal. But listen to Max talk about that record, and he says, I wanted to make music for arenas. And again, getting to know a lot of my heroes living at the studio, one thing that always interested me was the maturation of a band like Metallica. I'm 44, so I grew up in an era before Metallica was the Metallica that we know now today as the mainstream rock band. They were still a thrash metal band that were music for outsiders. Mm-hmm. It wasn't quite yet music for jocks that beat up outsiders, and which I always find extremely ironic. And I felt like after the success of the Black Album and then the subsequent success of Load, like, let's not forget, it maybe didn't sell as many copies as the Black Album, but at this point they're officially a thing. Mm-hmm. And that's the mm-hmm. album that follows up some of the more starting to be radio friendly sounds that you hear on the Black Album. By the time you get to Load, that whole album is very, you know, modern day rock radio friendly. Mm-hmm. And talking to a lot of the people from that scene, you know, they were no longer making music for Ruthie's Inn, and they were no longer making music for their peers to be like, yeah, that's the riff. It was like, nah, we're making music for the suburbs.
Right. And the malls. They were,
and I don't know if that's selling out per se. Mm-hmm. I don't have a definition for what a sellout is, because I think the moment you sell music, you're always going to capitulate to something. Mm-hmm. It's a whole different stratosphere that a band like that got to. So if you look at the way they got there, it's definitely, my opinion, you know, some people definitely gonna disagree. I think it's a pretty honest maturation that by the time they get to a certain point, it's like, look, we can't make music for 200 seat clubs anymore, because that's just, we're never going to be in one.
Right. Yeah, they had the potential to grow, and they had to decide whether or not they're going to accept that potential or continue to just try and be the band that they used to be. But after the Black Album, maybe it wasn't possible anymore. Oh,
yeah. There's like a team. Yeah, when you have a team, when you have to sit down with your management team, your life is going to be very different.
I really hate discussions around like, oh, did a band sell out? Did a band, you know, like, I don't know what selling out means. I know when a band sucks. Like, that's my criteria. Selling millions of albums and playing, you know, arenas and, you know, be hanging out with, you know, major celebrities on the weekends. And as long as your music's still good, like, I don't care. You're still doing something that I like. However, it does seem to happen that when a band does reach a certain point, like, basically anything interesting about them dissolves into air. Like, it just sort of gets aerosoled and, you know, blown away. And that's happened to so many bands that I enjoy. But I can also point to a band like Bring Me the Horizon, who, mm-hmm. you know, their album MO, and I'm probably saying that wrong, blew me away. Totally different direction for a deathcore album. Absolutely stunning production. Great songs. And, you know, they're like a huge band. Like, I don't know if they're as big as Green Day at this point, but they're a huge band.
Let's take them for example. This is a good example right here. Here you have a band that is in a micro genre called deathcore that is extremely limited. And the problem I have with, I shouldn't say the problem, a critique I have of the micro genre, and I'm using inverted quotes here, the micro genre, is that it's very limiting. It's extremely limiting. You're like, I only listen to polka, ska, speed metal. You know, that's very limiting to what the musicians can do within that genre. Mm-hmm. And it also, there's also something that people that go see you want. And what I found interesting about the deathcore genre is also one of the festivals I worked was EDC, which is Electric Daisy Carnival. And it was, when I was there, one of the largest festivals, if not the largest festival in Northern America.
Oh, really?
It was like 175,000 a day when I was there.
I knew it was big. I didn't know it was that big.
Oh, it's massive. I got to show you some of the pictures. It actually had some of the best pyro I've ever seen. But anyway, like, it was so big, it took me an hour to walk to my office.
Jeez. I had to go
through the festival. It sucked. But anyway, and it's not even that big. It's not a raceway. It's not even big. But anyway, a lot of the people there, younger people, had deathcore band shirts on. There was a huge crossover between to it was a huge through line of, I just want to hear the drop. So the colorful shirts that maybe a DJ like Marshmello had looked just like the colorful shirts that a band like Bring Me the Horizon had at the time. And everybody was wearing them. I saw tons of deathcore band shirts. And again, it's young people in those Hot Topic culture, right? But with that music, there's only so far you're going to go. And as you get and as you blow up in your genre, as you get popular, people are going to see it and they're going to think, this is the way to do the band thing and get notoriety, do the deathcore thing. We need a breakdown. That's what people want, right? So if you can rise above the sea of copycats, which is hard in my opinion, your music is probably going to take some turn. And if you've done it as long as these cats have done it, this was like they came out in the early aughts.
Yeah, I think their first album dropped in like 2005. I think they were actually kind of late for the whole deathcore thing. Like, they were definitely coming up at the time when it was almost kind of cycling out. Yeah,
but you know, if you look at the guys, I'm friends with some of the dudes from All Shall Perish, and you know, some of them aren't doing music anymore. It's life. You're in a micro genre, so you're never, again, micro genre, you're always going to be so little. But when you're a fan viewing it, you think that, oh, band X just opened up for much larger band, or I saw band X at this 400 or 500 cap room and it was packed and they sold a bunch of t-shirts, so they must be doing great. And it's like, well, there's a lot of expenses to get to 500 seat room,
right? They're not necessarily capturing every dollar that's coming in for that show.
It's
going out.
So and then you're talking about an all ages audience, and now we're talking about numbers like dollar per head, and you know, those are definitely the younger, if you notice, like, people have a younger audience, their shelf life is a lot shorter because venues can't make money when they come there. Even a packed house didn't make money.
Wow. Okay,
think about it.
No,
I need you to sell liquor. Mm-hmm. And you got a whole bunch of 12-year-olds. I don't care if they bought your shirt and I get a little bit of a cut of it. You know, I had to hire a staff. I had to hire more security to make sure no one's drinking illegally, to make less money than I would make if somebody was at half capacity, but everybody was drinking.
That's a really good point. And that's something that I think that, like, scenes have been struggling with for a while, is that, you know, there just are not all age venues anymore, for that reason specifically. So it's hard for a lot of people who want to just have a band to make connections, because if you want to play an underage show or a show for people who are not of drinking age, you're probably going to have to play at an illegal venue, and you have to know people to get in there, and you might get busted. Yeah.
Yes. No. And so what we're seeing right now is we're seeing a lot of these more historic venues throughout the country. You know, I saw the last time I toured with La Fena, we have some posters behind me, you know, people can't see because it's audio only, but there's posters behind me where all the venues are shut down. They were shut down in like 2016. And then you had a bit of a capture where, especially here in California, where a lot of the big promoters came in and started taking over venues to use it as a way to promote larger artists in smaller rooms. So by the time it got to festival time, they would take less of a cut or want less money for, you know, Coachella.
Oh, wow.
There's a lot involved in the whole capture of that. But mm-hmm. what ends up happening is it's harder for small band X to get off the ground and actually play in front of people. You know, even if you start talking about music in schools, like how do young people get instruments? Living in a rehearsal space, I saw tons of young people, but I didn't see too many people with instruments.
And
these rehearsal spaces, if you think about a rehearsal space, especially in a major metropolitan area that I've been in the San Francisco Bay Area, these are great meeting grounds and learning spaces for up and coming artists and the old guard. A lot of people that are older, more established seasoned musicians definitely like to help the younger people coming up, especially if they see something promising in someone. I can't lie to you or understate how much older seasoned musicians have helped me, from gear maintenance to just giving me stuff that I needed on the road. You miss that when these places A, don't exist, or young people just aren't able to get exposed to them.
Right. Yeah. There's not really a culture. There's not like an intergenerational exchange. And the culture is more online, so everybody is more isolated. Yeah.
Like the microphone I'm talking to you on, the cord that's plugged into the board, the guy that made the cord, the only job he ever had was working for the Grateful Dead. His name is Kid Candelario.
Dang.
And he made the wall of sound. Right, he's one of the architects of the huge, massive wall of sound they made. I got to steal stories from that guy. You know, just, kid, tell me more, tell me more, tell me more. Knowledge from that guy, just from being in this space. You know, that's, you can't put a price tag on that, right? It just changes the way you even go about music, because now you have this extra special appreciation for the environment that you're in. And those environments to me are somewhat sacred. Because I do see it as a bit of an incubation ground for young talent. Because you may go in the room thinking we're going to be the next deathcore band, right? But you walk down the halls and you hear so many different sounds. And you're like, holy moly, maybe that sounds really cool. And all this stuff influences you.
So do you think that maybe like the collapse of the culture and sort of the sociable aspect of being a musician, you know, like it sounds like that was maybe declining before the pandemic and certainly has during the pandemic. Do you think that maybe accounts for why we're hearing so many bands that are attempting to copy what they've already heard?
I think you saw that even before, right? I mean, look at the 80s. Look at hair metal in the 80s. That's just a sea of copycats. Oh, the guys from Quiet Riot, Motley Crue, got a blonde guitarist. We all need a blonde. Or they're wearing this makeup. We need this makeup. Oh, Guns N' Roses took their makeup off. Okay, let's get leather jackets and do that same thing. Like, you're always going to see a sea of copycats wherever there's success. But I just think there's something about being in an environment where I'm also like a competitive person. And getting a knock on your door and someone being like, dude, that's dope. Or hearing somebody doing something dope and walking over there and knocking on their door and being like, oh, dude, that's dope. I'm actually going to go rewrite a riff right now because I'm not going hard enough. That's hard to do when you're at home in front of a laptop.
Well, okay. So I'm getting a sense of what you think is important within your own development within this space. But what, as far as what you've seen generally within, you know, underground music, how do you think that sort of the breakdown of these spaces has, you know, affected young musicians and, you know, and the way that they approach music?
I don't know if it's organic, the stuff that people do, because you don't get a chance to really hear, how can I put this? A tastemaker is going to tell you what the new hot thing is, and you're going to go from there, because you're, a lot of people are kind of disconnected from these spaces. And again, one of the last tours we went on, I didn't really hear anyone that I thought was reinventing the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot of the same thing. And even when I talk to friends, it's a lot of, if this guy is hot, you know, we're going to all jump on this bandwagon. Oh, sludge metal is a thing. So everyone wants to slow it down, smoke a lot of pot, and do hallucinogens. Everybody's dressed like they live in the desert now. You know, if black metal is hot, everybody's a pagan. Deathcore is hot. Everyone wants a neck tattoo. It's almost like visually, I know what you do before I hear you sonically.
Okay, that's right. That's interesting that you would say that, because that was actually a complaint that I heard in like the 2000s from some old heads, was that like, oh, I can't tell what these kids are into just by looking at them. They all claim to be punk, but you know, who knows what they think that is. And
I've written about my idea about punk rock. I think it's a much deeper discussion that is uncomfortable for a lot of people, because I think we've projected onto the idea of even like the first wave of hardcore in the 80s, that these were like righteous cats that were all about the cause and were doing it for the love. And, you know, in some aspect, everyone's doing it because they love doing it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But is it really these altruistic, anti-authoritarian, anti-capitalist musicians, or is it a cottage industry that's formed out of the fact that these guys couldn't get into the mainstream? That sounds mean. It sounds like I'm just trying to belittle it, but in the world that I'm in with my regular job, I have to have a more analytical, more dialectical take on even the things that I love. And I think it's complicated.
So that's kind of that's more of a sociological or material understanding of the genre, but just in terms of sound and culture, like, you know, sort of downstream from all that, how would you define punk?
Oh shit. I don't know. I don't know how punk wants to define itself. I mean, I was watching a documentary about Abercrombie and Fitch the other day, and it opened with a Blink 182. Are they punk?
I don't know.
The thing I heard was Blink 182. And they'll be like, yeah, that's what got me into blah, blah, and blah. And then I went this way from it. You know, the first thing I heard was, you know, Van Halen playing Beat It. And I was like, whoo. You know what I mean? And now I'm doing this screamy stuff. So there's always some sort of sugary sweet intro drug that gets you into the more savory aspects of the genre. But really, I don't know if I can say this is or this isn't, right? Who am I to say? I think it's a bit of an attitude, but you can see that attitude in outlaw country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it clothes? Then that's not really a music genre if it's just clothes. So I don't know, because things that I say are punk, you can find it in different genres of music, in my opinion. Like, I do dig some Waylon Jennings. I think some of that stuff is punk rock as fuck. I think there's some hip hop out there that's punk rock as all hell, from the way they were putting on shows to the environment at shows. In the mid 90s, there was a rap group, and maybe people are not familiar with them, they're called Living Legends. There was stage diving at these hip hop shows in the mid 90s. You know, the idea of being punk to me, I wouldn't say I put it a genre label on it, because even the early days of what cats were calling punk, with that kind of first wave from CBGBs, outside of the Ramones, which is just sped up rock and roll.
I was expecting you to say Chuck Berry, but you don't have to.
Yeah,
have
same to thing, it on, right? It's just sped up.
Dude, yeah.
You know, when you think of, there's a guy, he actually came down to the, if you watch the Headbangers Journey, one of the documentaries that guy did, he actually came down to where I lived to film some scenes, because all the bands from the 80s were there at the time. Testament, Exodus, Death Angel guys. And you know, he has an interesting take where he takes the music all the way back to Sun Records and like the first scream on a record, which is Ike Turner.
Hmm.
Rocket 88. Mm-hmm. I think Rocket 88 is punk rock. You know, put that in. That'll get you going. You know what I think is punk rock? And people are going to be like, man, F this guy. Strange Fruit by Billie Holiday. That's one of the heaviest songs I've ever heard in my life. I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it. Strange Fruit, it is, yeah. Lyrically, and the chord changes. One of the heaviest songs.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing is that you have sort of a very emotional sort of connection to music, obviously, and that sort of emotional connection is sort of guiding your definition of what punk rock is, because punk rock is nothing if not like highly emotionally charged music. Like, oh my God. Yeah. Think about a hardcore band, like even like a beatdown band, yeah. Like Bulldoze, who are just like, you know, just like a shovel on the back of your head, you know, the entire time you're listening to them, and they're expressing, you know, their frustration with the world. And that's highly emotional. Yeah. Okay. So that does give me like a really good idea of how you're approaching your own music then, because one of the things I really enjoy about Bitter Lake is just how moody it is, and mm-hmm. just like how deep I feel like I'm sinking into that mood while I'm listening to one of your tracks. So I just want to get a comment from you about how mood influences your music and the mental state that you are like in while you're writing and making your music, and then like what sort of headspace you want your listener to get into while listening to it.
Ooh, well, you ask some very real serious questions that I respect and I'm jealous of, because I wish I could ask deep, smart people questions like that in my other life.
Not that smart. Just listened to a lot of music.
I get into, I'll be honest, I hope I don't take people down to the depression rat hole. So living in the warehouse was very sad because there's not much separating me from the massive homeless encampment that is across the street from me. And when I say across the street, I mean literally across the street. They are my neighbors. I have to deal with them. Sometimes I have to intervene in their daily goings on. And in the studio was its own drama, because there was a small handful of people that lived there, and that was its own thing that I won't get into. But seeing the plight of this population that I'm kind of a part of at this point, the unhoused population, how it's treated, how it's ignored, how it's viewed, and then working in it as well. So work for a time in homeless shelters definitely is going to drive the creative process, coupled with, just living in an environment where everyone around you is being creative, right? People only come into the space to work on music, so you're always hearing something cool. So it would be there's some pretty dark places that I'm in when I'm coming up with this stuff. And in my mind, I want to take you on the same journey I'm trying to take to get out of that darkness. I hope I'm doing something right. because sometimes I do get some pretty positive messages about the stuff that I do. I'm 520 miles away from my youngest son, who is three. I live this far south, not because I like surf and cheap tacos. Poverty forced me out of California. So there's definitely music I make for him that is under the moniker of Bitter Lake as well. I just decided that anything I make is just going to be under the moniker of Bitter Lake. You know, it doesn't have to be. And the band was actually really cool with that. We're like, we're cool with it. We know everything you do isn't going to be break down the walls heavy. And we actually dig it. So I don't think anybody is all the time, right? We have different moods. And I try to make different albums for different moods that we're in. We're in an interesting moment where everyone kept saying in 2016, we're going to get some great music. I'm still waiting to hear the great song that we're going to remember.
Like, when are we going to get to unbox some of that great music that was supposed to be coming in?
There's gonna be some great music. This definitely ain't 69, it ain't 68, it ain't even 84, So there's moods that we get in, right? Mm-hmm. There's loss that we feel. We're separated from one another. There's a loneliness that we feel. So trying to capture all that through different instruments. I feel like I'm not going to capture it all on my guitar. Not afraid to pull out a synth.
Yeah, yeah. And I do really appreciate the way that you are willing to pull out just a bunch of different instruments to try and give voice or give context to what you're feeling. And I'm specifically thinking about the transition on revolutionary mood music too. Yeah, revolutionary mood music too, where you go from a heavy sludge and sort of post-hardcore track on Suburban Breakdowns to like a Herbie Hancock style, like piano riff. Oh my God. Oh, that's so good.
Nick, you just, man, I'm about to text my co-host for my other job and tell him what you said. Look, man, I made that. I'll be totally honest with you. As my co-host always says, I'll be completely transparent with you. I love it when he says that. I always like pucker up tight when he says that. He's something mean. Suburban Breakdowns was written in a transition phase for me. I left my son's mom. I left my father's house. He wasn't doing well. We weren't getting along. And I was kind of stuck. I didn't know where I was going to go. And I have some really good friends in the Central Coast of California. They were like, oh, we got an extra room. You can stay here. You know, it's all good. And I got in there. And the first thing I did was set up my little recording setup. And I recorded Suburban Breakdowns. I also recorded the goth Snow White song in there too. Recorded a lot of stuff in there.
This is another banger. I love that song.
Recorded a lot of stuff in there. Goth Snow White is literally dedicated to, it's a husband and wife I was living with, and the wife is my tattoo artist. You know, people can't see, but you can see. And she is the goth Snow White. She actually has tons of animals and she sings to him in the morning. It's the funniest thing you've ever seen in your life. But also, you know, just walking up and down the street in the Central Coast is a different vibe for me, totally different vibe. And it just brought out a lot of different tunes. And I was like, I'm going to release a record. It's going to be all these feelings. And the band was kind of, you know, they're like, yeah, well, you're fine. I did it. And the response I got, I'm still shocked on the response that I got from that record. Part two, still to this day, because my whole thing was like, I'm going to release them on my birthday. I'm going to do two albums on my birthday. So I was just a recording machine. I didn't really leave too much just to eat, and sat in there and just banged out everything I was feeling at the time. And I'm very, very proud of that music. I still use that music on the video essays that I do. So I love those two records.
Yeah, and it's cool to hear you continue on that path with like your latest EP, Black Christmas. I think I had heard that you wanted to start releasing like an album every holiday, like every major holiday. Is that still something you're trying to do?
Mick, I was on this roll, man, and I was just writing. And what happened is my other job just took off. And before I knew it, my other thing that I do was to keep doing Bitter Lake. The plan was Bitter Lake is it, especially when we got back from the tour we did with Divide and Dissolve. And then even before we went out with Divide and Dissolve, we had done Brazil. So we were like, dude, Bitter Lake, this is going to be it for us. And I was like, you know, it would be really interesting if we had a podcast, but we just didn't talk about ourselves all the time. We live in this place, or I live in this place with all these people. We'll have different, our friends over. We'll talk music, we'll talk the world. And they were kind of like, that's a you thing. A few years later, it is a me thing. And it's, it's doing quite well. but Bitter Lake is still what I am. You know, I am always a musician first. And Black Christmas for me was, I was like, if I don't do anything on Christmas, I'm gonna really be upset. And my favorite group of all time, you're probably going to laugh at this, Mick, Massive Attack.
Oh, I can see that.
I love Massive Attack. Yeah. I love the Bristol sound. Le Fin, the band I was in, we got to do some recording in the UK. We were on this little bitty label, doesn't exist anymore. Based out of Bath, was isn't too far from Bristol, and the studio that we were in, Moles, is where like Jeff Barrow had done some stuff from Portishead. The Pixies had just got done recording there, and some other bands. So we were just like, dude, this is sacred ground.
Right. Yeah. No. What you were saying before about how important places are to you. Yeah.
Oh man. Yeah. Like I was like, so Jeff Barrow touched this board, right? So I'm all excited. And so Black Christmas for me was the first time I got to, I really wanted to cover Angel by Massive Attack, and I hate covers. And so we used to kind of mess around with it, me and the drummer a little bit. And I sat down and I was like, you know, I'm not going to cover it because then I'd have to find the drum loop they use, maybe change it, maybe replay it. I don't even want to do that. This is my homage to what I think is one of the best songs of all time in Bloods Part Two that starts off the Black Christmas EP. It is to this day, I think it is the best thing I've ever recorded because I actually sang on it. Like no screaming, just singing. I was like, I'm all about this song. Like I'm gonna do my version of Angel. If I was in the studio, it would have sounded like this. It would have tuned to drop F sharp, and it would have been like it would have went this way.
Wow. Okay. I mean, that's very cool. I did not pick up on that at all. Like I am also a Massive Attack fan, a massive Attack fan, but not as massive as you are, clearly. And I did not pick up on that, but that is super cool. I also like the fact that you are like making these albums as kind of like gifts to yourself. You released one on your birthday, you're releasing one on Christmas. Yeah, that's very cool.
I found the secret, Mick. And the secret is literally do it because you want to do it. Do it because you want to do it. It sounds stupid. Don't do it because you're going to get rich. Don't do it because you're going to get laid. Don't do it because you're going to get free gear. Don't do it because people are going to like you. Do it because you want to do it. I'm not going to release anything I don't want to release. That's a good feeling.
Yeah, that is a cool sentiment. That's the way I approach everything that I do with my own blog. I mean, obviously, I'm not as successful or as well-traveled as you are. But yeah, no, I love that sentiment. Cool. Yeah. And, you know, I'm glad to hear that it informs your sound and makes Bitter Lake what it is.
Yeah, we're all in a place right now where everybody kind of has their own thing that they've been able to do, their own outlet, if you will. And, you know, I'll be honest, and I don't know how this will affect people that go and tour still, which all of us in Bitter Lake are like extremely frightened to do. You know, the COVID ain't quite over just yet.
Right. Yeah. And you don't want to get stranded somewhere in case your tour gets canceled.
I've had friends that got COVID on the road and they had to like shut a tour down for a week and like hold up in a hotel somewhere. And luckily they had the funds to do it. That's cool for them. Knock on wood. And I'm going to do a live thing with my other career. Actually, a series of live things with my other career that are going to be much larger than anything Bitter Lake's done. So I'm like kind of nervous about this. But when we went out on that last tour, a bunch of guys in a van can get frustrating after a while, especially when we were out for a while. I think like 6-7 weeks or so. And we didn't have a lot of money, but we had so much fun on that tour. And we had a lot of beef with like the headliner and shit. But the tour itself, the bonding that we did to just have a good time. You know, there's more Planet Fitness gyms than any other gym in America. And for $20, you can bring a friend. So two people is $40 a month. You can get four guys in to the gym and you can go shower. It's cheaper than paying $10 a pop at the truck stop. And I told the guys, I was like, look, we'll get gym memberships. It's cheaper than taking a shower at the truck stop. And we'll feel better. Well, you know, even if you just get on the treadmill, walk around for a little bit, you'll feel better. And you know, one of the guys was like, dude, I can't believe I never discovered this before. All my years of touring, I feel great. We just exercised and every morning we can just do just silly stuff like that was just so much fun. As a unit, all of us, you know, doing a workout, which kind of might sound corny to people, but it was a bonding experience for all of us to start the day.
Mm-hmm.
We could roll with the punches that much better And it, of course, it was that much sadder when we finally got home and it was over. But we definitely, there will be a Bitter Lake performance towards the end of this year, most likely in the Bay Area. And I don't have a date yet. We're still working it all out with the booking agent, but it'll be a part of what I do with my other job. Bitter Lake is going to play one show.
Okay, sure. Cool.
Sure. Yeah. No. We're all super excited about it. Like, you know, I look forward to it more than anything else, but have you ever been, I don't know if you've ever been a touring musician.
No, I haven't.
It can suck. It could be the worst thing ever. No one likes playing to the bartender. No one likes looking for your dope fiend bandmate. No one likes stopping your drunk bandmate from making a fool of themselves. These are all the pitfalls and the downsides of touring. No one likes getting a phone call from home, finding out either their place is gone, their significant other is cheating. These are all the downsides, right?
Right, right. It's like being at war. Like,
it can be. Yeah. It can be like, oh, like nothing good is going to happen. And then
you lose guys, you lose your home, there are injuries, traumatic injuries.
We found this synergy where whatever was going to happen at home was at home. We weren't going to stop it. It just is what it is. We can't control the headliner. All we can do is kick ass and have a good time doing it. And we just had a blast. And we're different guys. You know, I'm boring as hell. I don't drink. I don't do drugs. Some of the other cats, you know, do some shit, but I'm boring as hell. And we all had a blast.
Cool. Well, yeah. I mean,
we're opening for a bigger band.
Right. Well, it helps. So are you opening for yourself then? Like opening for your podcast then? Like at this? Mm-hmm. Okay. Wow. Oh, wow. That's sort of a clash of worlds then. But I mean, it's all you. So
it was the plan all along. The plan all along was like, look, if we do this thing, if I do this podcast, it'll make the shows more interesting. The whole plan, and this is also how I think collectively, the whole plan was to do shows under the banner of Bitter Lake, like Bitter Lake Presents. That wasn't us. So a good friend of mine is a comedian and he opens for a guy named Dave Chappelle every so often.
Never heard of him.
You're a dick. But he wanted to do this thing. He goes, Jason, I got this idea. He goes, I want to do a hip hop version of the Rat Pack. And he goes, I'm going to put together this team of badass musicians and I'm going to tell jokes with a live band. And they're going to be playing music behind me from our era, like 90s hip hop kind of stuff, right? I was like, that sounds cool. He goes, but I need a place to rehearse. And we were going on tour at the time. I was like, well, just use my studio and rehearse in it. Please don't smoke in my studio. I like it to not smell like weed. Please don't do that. And I get back and of course the motherfucker has got roaches all over the place, right?
naturally. I mean, you told him not to, so
because I said no. That's why. Because I said, you can smoke in the hallway here. It's totally fine. Of course he doesn't, right?
You shouldn't have said anything because otherwise he'd be afraid of offending you. He'd be like, oh man, is he going to be mad if I smoke in this place? I better not.
I think he like blew smoke on my pillow. Like, motherfucker. And so we wanted to record this show because we called it Bitter Lake Presents. And we, you know, invited people over to the warehouse that we lived in. And the warehouse has a stage room. And it was a small group of people, probably like 30, 40. But it was one of the more entertaining, fun nights. I'll have to find you the vibe of MP3 of the night. And you might, some of the stuff is like you had to be there, inside jokes. But it was a really cool thing to put on. And that's what we wanted to do with Bitter Lake. We wanted to constantly be doing stuff under the banner of Bitter Lake that doesn't always have to be, you know, us screaming about, you know, the world. Like, we have friends that do other things that I think are very interesting, that even fans of people that want to hear some guys scream about the world can actually have fun and check out. And that's kind of what I feel like I get to do with the other life.
Okay. Yeah. And Bitter Lake is more and more just kind of like the band. And
yeah,
it's the house band. Yeah,
okay. It's the house band.
And your producer career. Yeah. Right. Your producer side project.
Yeah. It's the podcast is the side project for the house band.
Okay. I'm seeing how the Russian doll fits together now. Genius. That's a genius scheme.
So that's what I hope to do. I'd still like to do stuff like that. I would love to put not necessarily put people's music out, because I think it's silly. Put it out yourself. You don't need me. But as far as like, you know, doing shows and stuff like that, I think that would be a lot of fun to be able to you know, do shows like we did before with the Bitter Lake Presents. That was one of the more fun nights I had had. It felt like it never ended. we were hanging out for hours afterwards. And again, this guy had put together kind of a just team of real badass session guys that go out with much larger musicians. You know, session guys, you never know who the hell they are unless you're in the world. Mm-hmm. So it was a fun night, and I would love to do stuff like that again.
I would love to see something like that. Again, last time I went to a show like that was, I think Wire puts on a festival, kind of, and they played with like a John Spencer Blues Explosion, and they had a bunch of like other kind of cool, you know, sort of post-punk and, you know, sludge metal and bluesy type acts come through. That was pretty cool. But yeah, I'd love to see some smaller stuff like that. Again, I'd love to see shows in general. So come to Chicago.
Bring
it to Chicago at some point.
I'm still shocked. Oh, actually, Chicago is on the list of places that we are going.
All right.
It actually is on the list. For several reasons, I have to go to the Midwest. Definitely has more to do with the podcast career than it does the music career. But part of the live podcast show is always having a musical performance.
Nice. Well, Jason, we've been talking for, I think, close to an hour, maybe more than that. So I'm gonna let you go. But this was, I have another phone call that I need to get on to. But this was really fun. Thanks so much for taking the time to chat with me and just tell me all about your band, how the music gets made, and you know, sharing some of your hot takes. Like, everybody likes hot takes. I like hot takes. Thanks for serving some of those up.
Thanks very much, Mick.